Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Banter on the Parkway. I am your host, Brian, from BannersOnTheParkway.com. We've got ourselves a Malone and Stockton situation here. The pick and roll combo. It's just going to be a two-man game here. I'm here with Brad. Brad, are you going to be the picker or the roller?
I think those are the same person. Much like in Hot Fuzz. This might explain why we were never able to do that real well, Bri.
I think, honestly, it's because I was afraid of being inside the arc. And no offense, but I don't know that you necessarily had the height that when you were rolling to the basket, teams were like, oh, crap, the 5'8 guy, no. So, you know, more of a pick and pop combo. Or picking, I'm just going to shoot. I'm ignoring you after you set the pick. Anyway, so Xavier wrapped up their regular season this week. And it was more of a crash landing, I guess. Xavier went to Butler. This game really wasn't going to matter because Xavier's at-large hopes were basically dead by this point anyway, but it started 20-4 Butler and ended Butler 72, Xavier 66. Brad, I mean, there was a stretch of like 6.5 minutes to start the second half where Butler didn't score and Xavier scored 8 points. Did basketball die last Wednesday night in Indianapolis, Indiana?
Are you in reference to our dominant 12-0 run there that took only slightly over 9 minutes? Almost, yeah. 10 minutes to 12-0. Yeah. Looking at the KenPom game sheet on that is, it would be hilarious, I guess, if it were DePaul or somebody else, but Butler just stopped scoring. I think they went 17 empty possessions, 16 or 17. Yeah, and we didn't get within two possessions on that. Or, well, I guess got within two possessions. Didn't get within one. Cut that lead down to 5 while the other team went 11 minutes and 17 seconds without scoring. Less than ideal. Then they scored a bucket, which pushed it back out to 7. And from then on, it was just kind of math. Yeah. I don't know. This one was disheartening to sit down and watch, to say the least. Especially when it looked like they were trying to hand it back to us and we still just couldn't take it. I think at this, I mean, we all kind of knew, but I think at this point you looked at the team and were like, there's just not, the guys just aren't here. Quincy Olivari struggled. Dez really tried hard, which he's been doing most of the year. And Davion McKnight ran as fast as he could up and down the floor. And those are the three guys that matter. Unfortunately, they're just not, anybody else was going to hop in and help them. And Abu Usman continues to be probably the most frustrating post player, at least in recent Xavier history.
Yeah, I mean, this was, oh my gosh. It had been a long day for me anyway, on a personal level. And then sitting down to watch this, I made it probably 3 minutes into the game before I had to mute it because, I honestly was not, I knew I couldn't handle 40 minutes of Steve Lapis. And then, I mean, there was just such a long stretch where Butler refused to score the basketball and Xavier could not take control of the game. I mean, Butler was up 17 at the start of that stretch, but when a team goes over a quarter of the game without scoring at all. Not just they missed all their field goals, but they were getting to the line. They just didn't score at all. And, yeah, Xavier was still – that's the kind of stretch that has really, you know, doomed Xavier this year. And so it was really frustrating to watch another team do that and Xavier not be able to take advantage. So that was not great. Then senior night on Saturday night, it was Marquette 86, Xavier 80. This game was a much different tone. Xavier did not get off to a bad start. They really looked up for the fight. Throughout, there was a spurt by Marquette toward the end of the first half where they stretched the lead out to 9, but Xavier responded really well and led by as many as 6 in the second half before another, it was a stretch of almost 5 minutes without a basket from Xavier that ended up dooming them. This time. So, Marquette was without Tyler Kolek. Xavier still couldn't quite take advantage. Cam Jones had a fantastic game. I don't know what else you can say about this one. It was just, it was kind of a microcosm of Xavier's season, where the effort, I think, was there. There were good signs, but there was a stretch where they just couldn't get anything done on either end of the court. And no matter what they did outside of that stretch, they could not overcome that stretch where they just couldn't score and couldn't get stops.
Yeah, and I don't know how much is they couldn't get stops or is just Marquette is really good. Marquette missed 3 shots in the last 12:46 of the game. I didn't think Xavier's defense was terrible. I said against Butler, they ran out of, they just didn't have the horses. And I think that's kind of the same case in this game, only in a different way. They played well. They just don't have like guys that you can go to when everybody starts to get tired. And I think towards the end of that game, you saw fatigue set in a little bit. I don't love Twitter guys who are like, they just need to try harder or the effort wasn't there or whatever. I think, I agree with you. I think the effort was there. I think they just got tired. Marquette plays even faster than Xavier does, and they both play incredibly fast. So you got to the end of that game with both teams running up and down the floor as much as they could. And our 3 best players were at 39, 36, and 36 minutes. And Quincy Olivari had done a ton of heavy lifting to get X back into that game. Lazar Djokovic had 33 minutes. I think everybody just got tired. And Marquette is really good. Marquette is better. But the one thing that stands out about this game is that 19 players appeared in Xavier against Butler, and 5 of them had a positive O rating. Of all the players that appeared in this game, only 3 guys weren't over 100. So it was like the complete opposite in terms of basketball. We went from watching horrible offense to watching really good offense. A shout out to the always consistent Abu Usman, though, who was well below 100 in his offensive rating in both games.
I think one of the things that came out of this game that maybe could be seen as a positive was the play of Lazar Djokovic. He was a guy, before the season, a lot of people thought he might be the 5th starter. Because you looked, Usman was bringing experience. Obviously, the 3 guard spots were pretty much already decided. And it looked like Djokovic might win that 5th starting spot before his finger injury kept him out of the first 3 games. But, throughout the season, there had been some games where he had really struggled. He had started for you know, a pretty decent stretch of the season, but had never really put it together. And I think this week, honestly, in both games, he looked like a player who has what it takes to stick at this level. And I think a lot of people were wondering that, whether this would be Lazar Djokovic's 1 year of high major basketball. And I think he looked like a freshman who's starting to put it together during those last couple games. Against Butler, he had 7 points. Against Marquette, he had 9. He was able to play significant minutes in both games without getting himself into a lot of foul trouble. And he hauled in 4 offensive rebounds against Marquette as well. So, I mean, you see the sizes there, and I think the athleticism's there. And it looked like he was starting to kind of put it together. And so, you know, he looks like a player with some upside. Kachi Enzi looks like a player with some upside. And you wonder, you know, moving forward with Xavier, in theory, getting 2 big pieces back for the front court next year, what exactly the front court is going to look like. Because I think Enzi and Djokovic have both shown progress in the last couple of weeks. And so, you know, who knows? That's all to figure out during the summer, I guess.
You say, what's it going to look like? And at least on like a really basic level, you're going to have 2 guys who are really muscular with and like to rock braids or box braids, and you're going to have 2 really goofy-looking white guys. Lazar Djokovic is rocking that Dumb and Dumber haircut, and Zach Fremantle still thinks he can grow a goatee. So, I mean, at least aesthetically, there's going to be a real clash in looks there. It'd be very interesting. A Djokovic-Fremantle front court combination might be one of, like, it's just a combination of 2 really bad hair choices there. I mean, that's a frightening front court in definitely more ways than one.
But you looked at what Fremantle was able to do alongside Jack Nungi, who's another guy who could stretch the floor. And I think Djokovic's jump shot hasn't necessarily always gone in, but he certainly hasn't been afraid to shoot from the mid-range or 3. And that was when Zach Fremantle last year was extremely effective, was when teams had to guard Nungi all the way out there. And so I think Djokovic is a guy who could combine really well with Fremantle. Obviously, I think Jerome Hunter would be the main choice, but assuming Jerome Hunter can't play 40 minutes every single game next year, I think Djokovic and Fremantle could be a pretty effective combination on the offensive end, because Fremantle has shown if you are guarding the other front court player out to the perimeter, he's just going to go wreck you in the mid range and on the post. So, yeah, I, you know, I don't comment on people's looks, other than yours. But I don't comment on people who, are, you know, 10 inches taller than me's looks, I should say. So,
I'd like to say that I'm not criticizing either of them for how they look, because God made them how they look. I'm saying it's the hair choices, like Lazar. Dumb and Dumber was not like a barber's dream or something. Either grow it out or cut it all short, but don't stop halfway.
Fair enough. You know, I say get whatever haircut makes you happy. So it's hair. Who cares? It grows back. In most cases. Oh, sounds like a little jealousy talking there. One of the other things that came out of the Marquette game was in Coach Miller's radio show. He talked about looking forward to next season here, you know, having a team that's battle-tested and battle-ready. And I think some of that is probably coming out of these last few weeks where specifically Djokovic, NZ, and Trey Green have gotten a lot more run and been able to gather more experience. So that, I mean, it certainly doesn't sound like someone who's getting ready to move up I-71 and have all Xavier fans hate him. So as much as any coach is ever coming back, I think that indicates that Coach Miller intends to come back next year. So looking around at coaches who might not be coming back, Porter Moser. It was rumored that he is in talks to leave Oklahoma to go to DePaul. Then he put out War and Peace length denial on Twitter. Me thinks he doth protest too much. But anyway, Oklahoma's been all right this year. It is so hard for me to wrap my mind around leaving any high major job to go to DePaul. Brad, I mean, what is going on?
He's from there, or he's well-liked there? I have no idea. I saw someone say, DePaul has so much NIL money in a big market. And I'm like, he's in Oklahoma. Like, they're not struggling for NIL money. You know, Boomer Sooner and all that, they're not playing in someone's barn. Like, Oklahoma's doing okay money-wise. Just what a weird rumor. But I was willing to just kind of pass it by until he came out with the Thad Matta denial, which kind of makes me think that he was talking to DePaul. I did quote tweet it back to him with just the quotes from Thad Matta before he left Xavier for Ohio State. But as of going to pod right now, we've not been able to reach Porter for a comment on that really passive aggressive tweet that he undoubtedly ignored. So why would you go to DePaul? I mean, I was thinking about this last night. If DePaul offered me their head coaching job, how much money would they have to offer me to actually get me to leave my job where I'm not making six figures to go take that? And it's a significant amount. Like, why would you do that to yourself?
He's from Chicago.
Right.
Obviously had success at Loyola Chicago. He went to the Final Four. But I don't know. I don't know if maybe the seat is getting hot at Oklahoma. It looks like they are going to make the tournament this year. But, so I don't know if maybe he's hedging his bets. If they miss it this year, that would mean he's been there 3 years and not made it. Maybe with the move to the SEC, he is like, well, probably I'm not going to make the tournament next year if I can't make it this year, and then I'll get fired. So I don't know. But, yeah, it's a weird one. What's not weird is that it's March, and there's a dude on Duke who is doing his dead level best to make everyone hate him and his institution. So weeks after that horrific court-storming injury, which nearly cost him – his ambulatory adulthood, and almost made it so he couldn't windmill dunk 3 days later. Kyle Filipowski decided to go ahead and here's the thing. It wasn't like endangering Harrison Ingram's existence or anything like that. He stuck his leg up and tripped him as Ingram tried to run down the floor. And it wasn't like, he's trying to hurt an opponent and cripple him and keep it. It was just super petty, though. I don't know if you've seen the video of this, but he's just being a turd. So the question is, I'm assuming right now Jay Billis is in court getting like a warrant for Kyle Filipowski's arrest. Do you think Bilas is going to have Filipowski, like, detained or just straight up exiled, just like you're not allowed in America anymore?
Let's see. If you storm the court and bump into a guy, possibly causing what could be described as minor bruising, then he's already said you deserve to be arrested. Do we deport him, or is this a summary execution? Because, I mean, he pretty clearly – leg sweep is not the right word. But if you do what Kyle Filipowski does in, like, your local college open run, there's going to be a fight.
Yeah. And, well, here's the thing is I want to be very clear, because I think deportation would be sending him back to his country of origin. And as far as I know, that is America. So we're talking about exile here. Anyway.
I don't know what you do with him.
I'm assuming kind of, after how worked up Jay was over the Wake court storming, he's waiting to calm down a little bit before he addresses this. Well, possibly won't address it at all because he went to Duke and does not actually care about people's safety. He just wanted to rant about something because Duke lost. It could be the second one. I don't want to cast aspersions, but it does seem like it might be the second one. That Jay Bilas doesn't actually care about player safety. He just was mad Duke lost and threw a ranting, raving fit about it and wanted people arrested. In other news of people talking about basketball, Greg Gumbel, it was announced, is not going to be working March Madness this year because of some health issues within his family. This is just all around bad, right? I mean, since 1989, there have only been 4 years where Greg Gumbel was not at the desk for March Madness for the studio segments between games. Selection show is going to be a lot different without him. Ernie Johnson, I think, is probably going to be who ends up stepping in and filling that role, who I don't mind. But, Brad, I mean, Jim Nance, you know, stepped away last year without Greg Gumbel this year. I don't know. Does it diminish March Madness at all? For me, it was always a sign of the times when Greg Gumbel came on my TV and started telling me who was going to play.
Yeah, I really look forward to it, like 6:04 after the Big Ten self-indulgent final finishes, having him on there. I had not heard this until I looked at our script this morning. That's a bummer. I'm with you. I think Ernie Johnson does a good job. He clearly seems to enjoy the game. My concern is that this will dovetail into more of the NBA crew, and the rest of them I don't want anywhere near March Madness. But without getting into that, yeah, it's a bummer that Greg Gumbel's not going to be there. Hopefully whatever family health issues he's dealing with rectify themselves well.
Yeah, you know, lots of, like, national media people, I don't know, sometimes, like, the people who call the games the most end up being the most annoying. I remember dreading watching World Series games because I knew I'd have to listen to Tim McCarver and his rudimentary, at best, understanding of baseball. But Greg Gumbel has always seemed to make it more about the sport and about the players than about himself. So anyway, hopefully whatever is going on there gets well soon, and Greg is able to be back for March Madness 2025. But it is a bummer he's not going to be able to work it this year. And speaking of March Madness, we've had some automatic bids given out. Six have been clinched already as of recording. In the A-Sun, the Stetson Hatters are going to the NCAA tournament for the first time ever. The Big South, Longwood Lancers, Elijah Tucker is going to the NCAA tournament for the second year in a row. But super happy for Elijah after some of the things he went through health-wise at Xavier, that he's able to go back to the NCAA tournament in the Missouri Valley. It was a really good final between Drake and Indiana State, who is now going to have to sweat it out on the bubble because Drake was able to well, first they blew a huge lead, and then they came back and won. So really, really interesting stuff there from Drake. I might have, when I was up 16, just kept playing well, but they decided to play super badly for a while and then turn it on right at the end. In the OVC, Morehead State and Deontay Miles are going to the tournament after they knocked off Arkansas Little Rock in their final. Samford won the SoCon last night. No thoughts. No comment on Samford. No, I didn't watch the game. And then the Sun Belt, James Madison is going to be a trendy upset pick, and I don't think they're actually going to win a game because they are 22-0 in quadrant four. They have just made their money this year beating terrible teams, and I think they'll probably draw somebody good and lose immediately, but it's not going to stop Seth Davis from picking them in the first round to try and make himself look smart. So anyway, thoughts on the games we've already seen and the championship week coming up? What ones are you looking forward to? And you're not allowed to say Mountain West because we already know.
Yeah. Okay, I won't say that then. My thoughts are that Stetson going for the first time is a cool story. They did it on their home court. In the semifinal, Stefan Swenson of Stetson, actually of Brussels, Belgium, scored 14 points in the final 4 minutes to drag them back and win that game. Which I thought was going to be like their MVP performance until Jalen Blackman went for 36 in the second half, against Austin Peay in the championship game. So the team in that second half scored 58, which is just an outburst. Austin Peay hung right with them. It was a really fun game to watch. But at some point in time, Jalen Blackman just took it over. 36 in a single half is impressive. Other ones coming up I'm looking forward to tonight. Merrimack has a chance to win their first bid. Like to see Pat Kelsey get in again. But there's just so many games coming up. The ACC starts today with, I don't know. I guess the dregs of the conference are playing today. Same with the MAC, which is not the Mid-American Conference. I'm hoping that my graduate alma mater gets in. Akron was in a really good spot and then kind of spit the bit down the stretch, but there's just such a ton of good basketball. I've seen a couple tweets saying that championship week's even better than the tournament, which is probably not true, but which is definitely not true, but from today through the end of the first weekend of the tournament, you're just going to be watching really high intensity knockout basketball and Boston College.
Yeah. One I'm going to be keeping my eye on for a couple reasons is the Conference USA tournament, which starts tonight. First team All-Conference USA guard Kiki Tandy is trying to lead Jacksonville State to glory. They were in the tournament a couple years ago, but he's trying to take them from that 8 line all the way to the tournament. And I'm also going to be watching to see who Xavier is going to pick up and have him absolutely blow up next year. My guess is it's going to be Javonte Hawkins from Florida International, who shot 208 threes this year. I think he's going to be the next one off the assembly line. You know, you got Sule Boom, you got Quincy Oliveri. We've got a trend going here, and I'd like to see where it's going. Although it's entirely possible that Davion McKnight will be the star guard for Xavier, formerly of a Conference USA team, next year. And so then we'll have to wait a year to see who the next one is. But if I had to pick someone right now, it's going to be Javonte Hawkins, who opens tonight against Jacksonville State. So watch that game. You'll get to see Kiki do what he does best, which is shoot a lot, and possibly a preview of the dude who's going to show up at Xavier next year. No one's going to pick him to be the best transfer in the conference, and then he's going to end up being the best transfer in the conference. So that's what I'm looking forward to. Speaking of the best transfer in the conference, it was Quincy Oliveri, and he was named conference honorable mention. What a honorable mention it was, too. Led the conference in scoring. He was top 20 in the conference in basically every offensive statistical category. Killed it on the defensive glass, and the coaches were like, yeah, we'll throw him a bone. We'll give him an honorable mention. Brad, just how, Stanley Burrell has not called a press conference to address this, although I'm assuming I already know his thoughts, but how egregious of an oversight was this?
It's really egregious. I don't get it. He's the conference's leading scorer. And you would think like that probably puts you first team all conference. And okay, maybe if he took 50 shots a game to get there, maybe not, but he was efficient. He was top 15 in conference efficiency on the offensive end. He was top 15 in usage. He was top 10 in shots percentage. He didn't waste the ball. You know, this wasn't like a, when Allen Iverson lost a step kind of scoring. He scored well. I don't understand it. You know, he had a better defensive rebounding rate than Ryan Kalkbrenner. Trey Alexander was ahead of him and shot more and scored less. Dennis Jenkins was listed ahead of Quincy Oliveri, and Dennis Jenkins had a nice season. He did have more assists per game because he's a point guard, but he shot the same amount as Quincy Oliveri and scored 5 fewer points per game. Eric Dixon was ahead of him. He got half a rebound more per game, but Oliveri had more assists, more points. And despite the fact that Dixon had something of a reputation as a good defender, Oliveri had more steals as well. Oliveri was more efficient than Tyler Kolek. You can just keep going on, and you think, you know, we're Cleveland fans, and Albert Bell didn't win the MVP one year because he was, to use your words describing Kyle Filipowski before, a huge turd. But Quincy isn't. Like, Quincy went to be somebody's display at show and tell. He went and ate lunch with elementary school kids. He went to somebody's house because their poster that he had signed initially didn't get delivered correctly. So to make sure it did, he just took it to him. And then obviously, you know, took pictures with him. Like, I don't get it. If you want a college basketball player to represent your conference or your program on the court and off the court, Quincy is the guy you pick. Really good player, really good dude. I mean, he does podcasts that are kind of on the level of the one that we do, because I ask him to, and he shows up and he laughs and he talks openly about playing basketball. And, you know, there is no show that he won't go on. He's always doing goofy videos with Adam Baum. And he's a great player. I do not understand this. Cam Spencer was ahead of him and did everything worse other than shoot about a percentage point and a half higher behind the arc and 2 percentage points higher at the line, and scored 5 points per game less, had fewer rebounds. I don't understand it. I don't know if it's because Xavier finished 9th. I looked around for reasons trying to figure it out. Quincy, True to Form, just tweeted out that he was thankful to have been in the conversation. I don't know. He's by all measure a good guy and a great player. He teases Daylon Swain constantly on Twitter, which is hilarious, with old clips of Daylon Swain talking about himself. He's going to go down as one of my favorite guys who have ever pulled the jersey on, just because of the way he conducted himself on and off the court. And it was a little annoying to me that he got snubbed so badly. I tried the devil's advocate it in the article that I wrote, and it doesn't make sense. You cannot look at the numbers on most of the guys listed ahead of him and make it make sense. I mean, if you looked at Oso Iguodaro and Quincy standing next to each other and asked which one had more defensive rebounds, 95% of the world would get it wrong. Because Quincy had out-defensive rebounded Oso Iguodaro, who is 8 inches taller than him. And that's if you believe Quincy's actually 6'3". When Brad Colbert is listed at 6'2", and when they're standing next to each other, Colbert looks suspiciously like he's at least the same height or perhaps a little taller. But I don't know. It's awesome that Quincy can say that he was thankful to have been in the conversation, but since I'm a guy who can just be mad online for no reason, that was the route I went. So he should have been first team. It's a shame that he wasn't. I sort of hope it motivates him and he goes on just a 4-game heater, the likes of which we haven't seen since Kemba Walker in Madison Square Garden. That would be awesome.
Yeah, if you sort just by conference statistics, which is what they are supposedly basing this on, Quincy was second in the conference in scoring, slightly behind Devin Carter, who I think should be conference player of the year and won't be. But, you can't look at the numbers and go, wow, there's the reason why someone who was ahead of him got picked ahead of him. I don't get it, but anyway, he was robbed. It is nice to see that he can shake it off. I can't though. No. So anyway, looking around the Big East, if we're just kind of looking at where the Big East sits on the bubble, still looking like a 5 or 6 bid league. Villanova did their dead level best to torpedo themselves this week. They lost to Seton Hall, which is not good. Then in their final home game of the season, they were hosting Creighton, chance to get a huge win, get themselves up off the bubble, and allowed Creighton to start the game on a 23-4 run. It was something crazy. Where Creighton was, it was 32-8 at one point. I mean, it was just an absolute, 24-3. So that's not good. They then battled all the way back only to lose at the buzzer to a Trey Alexander runner. So I've said all season, I have no idea what the heck Villanova is doing. And I stand by that still, because what on earth is going on there? I can't tell if, I can tell. Seems like their fans are already sick of the Kyle Poseidon experience after 2 years. There was a significant amount of booing when they were down 21 in one of their most important games of the year. So they are squarely on the bubble. They right now have a 52.2% chance of getting an at-large bid. St. John's really helped themselves, as did Seton Hall this week. St. John's beat DePaul in Georgetown, which I guess doesn't really help, but they walked through the minefield and missed So they are now sitting at an 88% chance of getting an at-large bid. So it seems like Rick Pitino is going to make it in year one after declaring that they were not going to make it in year one, which is interesting. Rick Pitino is just – he negged his team into playing well. You know, it's an interesting move. I'm not sure I'd have done it, but good for Rick. And then Seton Hall got that big win against Villanova and also won DePaul Roulette. So they are sitting at about a 73% chance. And then you get to Butler, Providence. Have minimal chances. I think if they make a run at Madison Square Garden, they might be able to get in depending on what else happens. And then Xavier, Georgetown, and DePaul have to take the auto bid. And only one of those teams has indicated that they are in any way capable of it. So that's what the Big East is looking like on the bubble right now. I think the Big East is going to get six teams, but I'm not sure.
I think the top five will probably make it. St. John's is close. If you looked at any coaching, we're going to pick one who negged his way into success. I think Rick Pitino would, in his white suit, would kind of jump out right at you. You walk into a bar, you see Rick Pitino wearing that suit, you're like, I know what that guy's game plan is. Villanova, man. They should have been in. The problem that Villanova put themselves in is they played DePaul in the first round, which great. Basically, all you do is get sweaty for 40 minutes there. But now they probably need to beat Marquette, and that's a tough ask. And Providence ends up in a spot where they probably need to beat Creighton. If either of those teams pull that off, then yeah, I think the Big East gets six in. Otherwise, it could just be five. And I just to briefly look at Xavier's chances, it's Butler in the first game in the first round. And then that's probably a winnable game. Well, it definitely is a winnable game. The problem is that Xavier has to win the auto bid. And I guess in the idea that you do the hardest part first, they would then face UConn in the quarterfinals. Our games against UConn didn't go great this year. So that's a little concerning. UConn last lost to Creighton on February 20th, and they got thumped. The last time they lost before that, it was still 2023. So, yeah. Could be a low-stress weekend for us.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is this. Xavier has to win the auto bid. I think Providence, I think they would have to beat Creighton and Marquette. I think just beating Creighton doesn't do enough. And if they beat Creighton and somehow they meet Villanova, I don't think beating Villanova does enough. So I think it has to break right for Providence on the rest of the bracket for them to be able to get enough good wins. I think they need both those wins. And then Villanova is just, they are drunk. I have no idea what they're doing. It's incredible to watch, though.
They really looked like they had played themselves back. After they beat Providence, they looked like they put themselves back in a really good spot to make the tournament. And then they just spit, they just needed to win one of the next two games. And I know we've said this about Xavier all year. And then they just didn't.
I feel like this must be what it was like for other people watching Xavier during the Travis Steele years, where it would be like, all right, all they have to do is just win one of these games and they're in. And it's just, it's fascinating to watch, and I hope it never ends. Because every year, Villanova is just, they're just, folks, it's absolute cinema. Anyway, so that is, I mean, that's what we're looking at the Big East tournament. Everybody, well, a bunch of teams are there with a lot to play for. Three teams are there really kind of needing the automatic bid or nothing.
I think Butler needs it too. I don't think Butler, I don't think even a run to the final gets it done for Butler. I think they also need the auto bid.
I think if Butler, if Butler beats, so you don't think if Butler beats Xavier, Connecticut, and then say St. John's, you don't think that gets them in?
No, I don't think so. They're not really, like Xavier, they're not showing up on a lot of the bubble watches or anything. They're obviously not anywhere on the bracket matrix. If you look at their, you know, their body of work is not awful, but it's also not great. I don't see a path. And their net, which I realize is just a sorting tool, is lower than Xavier's. They're 4-11 in Q1. I guess the one thing they don't have is a bad loss. So if they stack a few more wins, maybe. But for one thing, I don't think they will. And for another, I think they got to have the auto bid. They've not beaten a good team, depending on what you call a good team, probably since February 2nd when they knocked off Creighton. Since then, since the 2nd of February, they've won 3 games, and it's been Providence, DePaul, and Xavier. So they've done nothing to help their resume for quite a long time.
Punching it in, if they beat Connecticut, beat St. John's, and lose to Creighton, that gives them an 82% chance of getting an at-large.
Well, I hope
them. That would put them on the 9 line, it looks like. So I think that is enough for them. But, boy, do I hope it doesn't happen. So, yeah. But, yeah, I think under certain circumstances, if Butler and or Providence makes the title game, they might still get in. So, anyway, we do have one question here. Who should be the 4th 1 seed? Tennessee.
I got North Carolina, actually.
What? No.
I would lean North Carolina there over Tennessee, but I think North Carolina, Tennessee, or Arizona are all good picks, or dark horse here, Marquette wins the Big East tournament, and one or two of those teams don't win their tournament. I think you could see Marquette sneak into that one line as well.
I think Arizona probably did themselves in for the 4th number one seed by losing to USC, who is abysmal. Which is incredible. So, yeah, I don't know. Because I don't know, even if they win the Pac-12 tournament, if there are enough good wins to be had in the Pac-12 to push themselves up over North Carolina or Tennessee. I think it's pretty much down to those two, unless they both bomb out early, and then it could open it up to Creighton or Marquette, I think. I think if Creighton beats Marquette and Connecticut at Madison Square Garden, they could play themselves onto the one line as well, depending on what else happens elsewhere. But I think Tennessee has the inside track, and I think they'll get it done, which is not to say that I think they are going to be a Final Four team, but I think they'll get the 4th one seed. So anyway, we are one final thing to wrap up here. We all guessed what DePaul's point differential would be at the start of Big East play. That was prompted by Muskie Commenter, who said that it would be negative 340 points averaging a 17-point loss. Brad, you said negative 190. You were bullish on what Tony Stubblefield was going to be able to do. Joel went negative 219. Braden went negative 250. I went negative 265. In reality, it was negative 429. They averaged a 21.45-point loss per game, which I did not see coming because I was like, I think it's going to get ugly, and I think they are only going to win one game, and then they did not even do that.
It did get really ugly.
It did get really ugly. And, I mean, Georgetown beat them by a combined total of 4 points. And then the rest of the conference in 18 games beat them by 425 points. Oh, my goodness.
They are in with they're 315th in efficiency, which puts them right between Bellarmine and a team that I honestly didn't know existed, Charleston Southern. In the Big South Conference, the Charleston Southern Buccaneers are as good as DePaul is, and Bellarmine is better than DePaul. Other teams better than DePaul, Sacramento State, Bethune-Cookman would have given the Blue Demons a run this year. Lemoyne, I believe the Dolphins, yes, the Dolphins out of Syracuse, New York, for whatever sense that makes. And their first year in D1 were better than DePaul was. So great job, Tony Stubblefield and others. And great question from Muskie Commenter. That was fun.
That was. And I think, boy, was I mean, I was like, it's going to be ugly, but they're not going to lose by 17 tonight. And, well, I was right that they weren't going to lose by 17 tonight, just in the wrong way. Anyway, Xavier Player of the Week, final edition of a regular season. Brad, who do you have?
I've got Quincy Olivari in the crime against basketball that was the Butler game. Nobody really stood out, and I've been trying to forget that. So then in the game against Marquette that X really needed to have, Olivari stepped up like he has at home all year. It just wasn't quite enough. But again, he went for 32. A lot of people heralded Cam Jones's effort to win that game, and he was good, but even he wasn't quite as good as Quincy was in that game. Yeah, I guess in a week where one of the games was physically painful to watch, and nobody did much, it kind of came down to that last game, and Q was really, really good in that one. And almost was good enough.
Yeah, I went with Olivari as well, simply because, like you said, no one really played very well at Butler, and he played extremely well against Marquette on his senior night. Shout out to Brad Colbert, who also got out there on his senior night, forced a turnover. Gonna miss both of those guys, probably for different reasons, because Colbert never really lit it up like Quincy does, but, you know, he was an effort player. So, but yeah, I went with Olivari as well.
Kind of harsh on Colbert. You know, he had an O rating of 181.2 in conference-only games this year. I'd say that's lighting it up. Did not miss a shot from the field for the entire season. So, I get it. You're saving him for your pick for player of the year, not for player of the week. But, that makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah, you know, because, like, hey, sometimes you spread out your greatness, and I think that's what we've seen here. You know. Like Hank Aaron. I mean, he was really, really good for just a really long time. But, you know, you look at his best seasons, they weren't like the greatest seasons ever, but he just had a whole bunch of them. And that's what we saw with Brad Colbert, the Hank Aaron of basketball, as many people call him. Anyway, so yeah, I went with Oliveri as well. But I think Colbert bears mentioning, as it was his senior night as well. And I think he's brought something to the table this year that should be noted. So anyway, that is it for us this week. Thank you guys so much for listening. Xavier is in tournament action. So they will play Butler at 4 p.m. on Wednesday. And if and when they play again, depends on the result of that game. So we will be watching right along with you guys. And we hope that you all have a great championship week. You know, man.